Well, I feel like I'm actually a part of the family reunion now, different from last night. I have had such a good time. Really have enjoyed some of the one-on-one times I've had with people and playing with the kids and connecting with my friend Tim. Again, I've really had a great time. So thanks for including me in your party. And how wonderful to have Seamus stand up with that earnest little face. That was just so precious. What a gift. Well, we talked this morning about roots, and we're going to talk this evening about branches. And we're going to connect it with that phrase again from John 4 about those who worship in spirit and in truth. And we're going to look at how worshiping in truth has something to do with branches. And I hope I'm going to connect that for you. But I want to start by reading a very famous passage in John, another passage in John, that was the first one that I thought of when I thought of doing some reflecting on branches. And I think you probably know the one I'm going to read. But try to listen to this again with these images that we've been exploring about flourishing. Imagine a green and vibrant branch as opposed to the withered branches talked about in this passage as well. This is John 15, verses 1 through 8. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You have already been cleansed by the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me as I abide in you. Just as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit, because apart from me, you can do nothing. Whoever does not abide in me is thrown away like a branch and withers. And such branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask for whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and become my disciples. As a tree begins growing, branches emerge. It's not what happens first, it's what happens after the roots have gone down, the nourishment has come up, and out goes the branches. It's a natural expression of growth and life. A tree that does not do that, there's something wrong, isn't there? There's a flow of the life coming up from the roots and going out into the branches. We start by receiving. We love because he first loved us. You know, there's a movement from childhood to adulthood that kind of patterns this as well. When a child is an infant, they don't do a whole lot, do they? They just receive. But as they begin growing and developing, it's very natural to say, let me try. I want to do it. I want to have a chance. I don't want to just receive. I want to be an actor, not just a receiver. It's a very natural development of moving into maturity. Passivity, when that is absent somehow, you could call that a failure to thrive, couldn't you? When that movement of not wanting to be in the game, of not wanting to be in the action. You know, it makes me think of a very powerful experience I had when I was a graduate student, and I knew very little about parenting. I hadn't babysat a lot. And I was studying children and psychology, but I hadn't had a lot of experience myself. And I went to dinner at one of my friends who was in the grad program with me, and she was a little older and was married and had two small children. And I'll never forget being 23 years old and being at their house for dinner. And after dinner was over, the mom and the dad had this little plastic table, those kind of blue and yellow kind that are in the house of most families that have kids that age. And on that little plastic table, there were these bowls that had whipped cream and sprinkles and cherries and maybe ice cream balls or something. And these little kids who couldn't be older than 4 and 5, got to take a bowl for each of the grown-ups that were at the table and fill it with whatever they wanted and bring it to the table, and that was the dessert you had. So some people had a big pile of whipped cream with just a few sprinkles on top. Other people had just sprinkles that they were supposed to eat with their tongue only. There were instructions for the dessert. But I marveled at the joy that we were experiencing with dessert. In such a natural way, these children were included in our meal. And what they presented and what they added to the dinner was a delightful and a joyous part of our time together as a family, as grown-ups. And I think about how different that is in lots of other families, where there is more of a focus on how something might look, presentation or perfection. And a little child who's beginning to learn how to try something, very often I think might experience shame or discouragement if they don't do it right or they don't do it well. And that certainly can add to a kind of passivity that ends up keeping us from this natural movement of extending ourselves as we grow and mature into the world with a freedom and with an expectation that what we do will be of value. Trying is going to involve risk and sometimes failure. One of the favorite essays I've ever read by an author I love, Frederick Buechner, is an essay that he has called Adolescence and the Stewardship of Pain. And he talks again in this essay about this movement from childhood into adulthood. And he talks about adolescence as this kind of cusp between childhood and adulthood. And that, like in the insect world, there's actually a name for that middle thing. You're like, I don't know enough, but some of you biologists here, is it the pupa? Is that the middle stage or the larva? One of those two. And then there's the adult bug. And what Buechner says is that in this middle ground between childhood and adulthood, this is what he says, it's when pain begins to start counting. When we're little and something bad happens, our friend spits on us, or we get tripped, or someone takes that treat out of our lunchbox, and we can have big feelings of hurt. They can be cleared up, can't they, by dinner time? A cup of hot chocolate, a hug, something can take that pain away very quickly and we bounce back and we're resilient. But something happens in adolescence where we begin to keep track. And all of a sudden it's different. And what Buechner says is it's exactly this very process of how we begin to manage pain in our life that helps us move from childhood to adulthood. That's what gets people stuck that never grow up emotionally, is they don't learn how to manage the pain in their life. They either begin denying it, or they begin just building up resentment, they begin to develop that identity of a victim, but something gets stuck in their movement of pain, how they process pain. And the people that become healthy, mature adults begin to figure out that this is a part of life that I need to learn to deal with. To me, it has something to do with these branches, with stretching out into places where I haven't gone before, taking risks, sometimes failing, learning what to do with the pain that comes when I stretch out like that. Richard Rohr is a Franciscan priest, another person that I derive a lot of spiritual benefit from. He has a center in New Mexico called the Center for Action and Contemplation, and he's done a lot of work with male spirituality. And he's studied initiation rites across cultures. He's very interested in how we help boys become men, but it's also about younger people become adult people. And so he's looked at these initiation rites across cultures, how different cultures kind of try to mark this process and passage into adulthood, and he's found some commonalities with these passages. And here's what he's found, that there's the process of a rite of passage is to impart some very, very important life lessons to younger people as they become adult members of a community. And Richard Rohr says that the life lessons that seem very common across cultures in these initiation rites are these. Life is hard. You're going to die. You're not that important. You're not in control. And life is not just about you. Isn't that interesting? And he says that in our culture, look at what gets expressed to our young people often. Life can be easy. You can stay young, or at least look really young, forever. You are what's most important. Above all else, stay in control. And life is totally about your achievement, your happiness, and your fulfillment. The exact opposite of what often helps in lots of other cultures for people to move from childhood to adulthood. What he says, and what I believe very strongly, is that these are dangerous illusions that grip a lot of people's lives for their entire life. These are illusions of what life should be like, or what a flourishing life is like. It makes me think of a postcard that I have had on my refrigerator for a long time of like a mermaid, and she's on a rock, kind of looking out to the ocean, and underneath it says, "I will always love the false image I had of you." And I think that that idea of the illusions that we live with, whether it's in love, whether it's an illusion about how the church should be, how a job should be, how marriage should be, what parenting should be like, many people labor under these illusions and are constantly feeling discontented or like a failure, rather than recognizing some of those first things I said about the difficulty of life. And the fact that it's not about me. And I'm not in control. I'm so much smaller than I wish I were. So getting back to this idea of what it means, how is this connected to what it means to worship in truth? When I hear that phrase in John 4 of the people that will worship me, the Father will look for people that worship in spirit and in truth. We talked about worshiping in spirit. And in my mind, when I think about what it means to worship in truth, the words reality and integrity come to my mind. And as I just got done saying, I think part of what it means to grow up and to become an adult person is to be disillusioned, to be stripped of our illusions, and to be living in reality. Not the reality I'd like to create, but reality as it is. And that worshiping in truth means that what is on the inner part of me is what I'm going to be expressing in my outer life. As I'm stripped of these illusions and I'm trying to embrace reality, just like in my deep love relationships, who I am on the inside is who I want to be on the outside. And for many, many, many of us, we have much more of a foot, we have a foot in two different boats, I think, where we have a public self and we have a private self. And what you see on the outside is very different than what you might feel on the inside. And so my public self meets your public self. And we may be trying at times to impress each other, and I'm afraid to tell you some of the things that are on the inside of me because I think you won't respect me, or you won't think I'm a very good Christian, or you won't like me. But I'm not living in truth. Our relationship isn't really in truth. And how can I worship in truth? That idea of integrity and reality and what I am on the inside is what I am on the outside. And isn't that exactly, when we think about what's been so damaging in the church, why so many people, including my dad, who is one of the best men that I've met in my life, will have nothing to do with the church, because as a young boy growing up in his Episcopal church in Minneapolis, he saw lots of people that what they were talking about in church was not how they lived their life on the outside. And that's not who my dad is. He is a person of incredible integrity. And I've tried to tell him, and I've tried to live out before him, you know, that Christians are very sinful, broken people like everybody else. And don't look at us, look at God. But something in his mind and what he'll end up bringing up, and he can't bring up example after example after example about what's on the inside for lots of Christians isn't what ends up being expressed externally. And Isaiah talks about that in Isaiah 58, and I think it's a really important thing for us to keep remembering all the time. This is Isaiah 58, verses 1 through 12. Shout out, do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet day after day they seek me and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments, They delight to draw near to God. Why do we fast, but you do not see? Why humble ourselves, but you do not notice? Look, you serve your own interest on your fast day, and you oppress all your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? But is not this the fast I choose? To loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them, and not to hide yourself from your own kin. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and he will say, "Here I am." If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger and the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. I believe this is exactly what worshiping in truth is about, where what is in a person's heart is what's being expressed, and not that there is a religious action that's devoid from this kind of heart of compassion. So from this passage, we see that what God is really interested in, what it means to worship in truth, is about freedom and healing, generosity with those who have less. These are what our branches are to be made of: hospitality and compassion. And when we choose to hide from suffering, you know, I have people that I work with that I've heard them say, you know, "I just don't watch the news anymore. It makes me too anxious, or it makes me too depressed. I don't feel safe in that neighborhood, so I don't go there." Or, "I don't think everyone is called to minister to the poor." But I think that when we hide our face from suffering like that, our branches are being clipped, and we become a dead branch. We're not bringing that love and that light and that grace of God to those places that need that. You know, again, in this image of growing up, Gary Haugen, whose book Good News About Injustice is one of the books that in the last few years has made more of an impact on me than any other book. He has this wonderful part in the beginning of the book where he talks about how in growing up, a child at the beginning of life doesn't have what's called object permanence, and probably a lot of you know that. Why that game Peekaboo is so delightful to so many kids, because at a certain stage, when your face is hidden, you're gone. And then there you appear again, and then you disappear, and there you appear again. And so when you are out of sight of an infant, you don't exist. And he says that what he longs for the church to develop is what he calls compassion permanence. So that even when we don't see suffering around us, we know it's there. That our compassion is permanent. That we don't have to be in the face. How easy it is at times to read a newspaper about atrocities happening in another part of the world, and then move on to section C and find out what time the Giants game is on tonight. And at one level, that's okay. You know, I don't think that we need to be constantly basking in the pain of the world. We need to be able to embrace the joy of a Giants game or an Oakland A's game. But can that permanence, where our heart is still aware and seeking and praying and what's on the inside, we really are attempting to have in our outside life some expression of compassion and care for the people that are oppressed and have less than us. To worship in truth, we have to live in reality. And many of us will consciously or unconsciously choose these illusions or delusions rather than to live in the truth. And another part that's so interesting to me too is that when the scripture tells us over and over and over again that we can't love God if we don't love our neighbor. And what is so interesting to me is it doesn't say that we can't love God if we don't serve our neighbor. It says that we have to love our neighbor. That is a heart position, not actions. Again, as I draw from my experience as a marital therapist, I've had many, many couples that will come into therapy, and they've been married for a long time, and there's very little love left in the marriage. And one of the other people in the relationship will say, well, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've served you this way. I've provided a good living for you. I've cooked all your meals, or I've done this for you. I've raised the children. I've served you in all these ways. What more could I do? And what we end up getting at is how what needs to be at the heart of an intimate relationship is not about actions. That's even what the chapter in Isaiah says. It's not about what you do. We're not called to just serve our neighbor. We're called to love. And if there's one thing I've learned about love, the older I get, is that empathy is one of the pillars of what it means to learn to love someone. I've learned a lot about love in being a mom. One of my best teachers has been my daughter, Catherine, who's now 19 years old, and she is very, very different from me. This is for those of you that know about the Myers-Briggs. I am an ENFP, an extroverted, intuitive feeling, kind of processing type. My daughter is the exact opposite. She is an ISTJ. She's a rational, introverted, scientist type person who does not like to talk about her feelings. Now, part of me thinks that it's her individuation from me and that when she gets older, she'll talk about her feelings. I don't know if that's my fantasy, my wish, or if it's really true. I don't know. But I do know that we've struggled in our relationship for a long time because I kept wanting to know what was in her heart and hear about her feelings. And her way of expressing love to me was to run across the room and jump into my arms and wrap her legs around my waist, or to lay her body across me on the couch when we were watching a TV show together, or put her head on my shoulder and want me to stroke her hair. And when I missed that for a long time and I kept wanting to ask her how she was feeling, and she'd get frustrated and she'd clam up and then I'd get hurt and then we'd get tense and we'd get angry and we'd have a fight. Finally, one day when she was 17 years old, I'll never forget this, and we went through that snowball where I was wanting to connect with her and know her, and something really important was happening in her life, and I wanted to know how she felt, and she was feeling I was being intrusive and needy. Mother, go get a life, get your own friends, back off. And I remember her just yelling out at me, "Do I have to be like you for us to be close?" And it just pierced me, the truth of her statement. Do I have to do it on your terms? Is that really the only way we're going to have a good relationship? And, you know, those things that you help other people to do all the time, and then you find out how poorly you're doing it in your own family. I knew in my head that you have to learn other people's love languages and try to love them in the way they need to be loved. But it's very hard, isn't it, when it comes to your own life to do that? And so when I think about this idea of branches and loving our neighbor, I think about what it would mean to just begin to try to develop empathy for people that live in very different circumstances. You know, Hebrews 13:3 says, "Remember those in prison as if you were fellow prisoners." Isn't that a beautiful statement of empathy? What it would be like to just begin trying to develop some empathy, rather than shielding ourselves from that because it's too painful. What I've learned about love is that love is very messy and very vulnerable. That love, just like that phrase, truth hurts, love hurts. It's not nice, but love, like it says in 1 Corinthians 13, love doesn't give up. Love doesn't give up. And so in this attempt to try to figure out how to be a tree planted by streams of water with my roots going down and my branches extending to the people that God cares about, I want to encourage each of you, just don't give up. Don't shut down out of despair because it hurts too much. Or don't shut down because you don't feel adequate or comfortable with anything that you could do. Begin, even if you can, just by trying to develop some empathy. By reading a book like Good News About Injustice, or going on a trip like Tim's gone to Goma so many times, put yourself in the places where there are some people very different from yourself and let your heart be touched. And let yourself begin to love somebody very, very different from yourself. Living a life of love. There's a beautiful prayer in Ephesians 3 that I think is very much in line with our theme for the weekend that I want to read that I think gives us some more beautiful pictures about this. Ephesians 3, 14 through 19. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth takes its name. I pray that according to the riches of his glory, that he may grant that you may be strengthened in your inner being with power through his Spirit, and that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, as you are being rooted and grounded in love. And I pray that you may have the power to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Isn't that a beautiful image of our tree soaking up the nutrients by the river of life and extending that in branches to places that desperately need the light and the grace and the love of God? So it begins with our own roots. It begins with our gratitude. And again, as that passage about love your neighbor as yourself, it really begins with the love of your own self. And this is a question that I'll ask people often in my office. Would you want someone to love you the way you love yourself? How do you take care of yourself? How do you tend to yourself? It really is important if we're going to live this life of love, both in our relationships with God and as branches into the world, that we take that very seriously. We have to begin with a sense of taking good care of our own self. The other idea that I think about connected to this is the concept of hospitality. And I want to ask you for a minute, to even as we're thinking about love and empathy, when you think of hospitality, you know, I would love a couple people just to shout out. What words come to your mind when I say that word hospitality? Women. I'm sorry?
Women.
Women, okay. Work?
Warmth.
Food.
Sharing.
Safety.
Accepting.
Inviting. I think hospitality is a very, very, very important component of love, and love of self and love of neighbor. Inviting and warmth and food and nurture. Think about Jesus exhibiting hospitality. The Greek word hospis, where hospitality comes from, is the word both for host and guest. And kind of tying in with what I said this morning about all intimate relationships always being reciprocal. That in hospitality, you know, Jesus even invited himself to dinner at times, didn't he? Do you know that that's a way that you can actually be hospitable? No, I mean that. Inviting yourself into someone's life, building a bridge like that to another person, I want to get away from hospitality being you come to my house and I have everything all beautiful and perfect and I entertain you. That's not biblical hospitality. Inviting yourself to someone's house can be hospitable. Asking for an invitation, as well as washing their feet. I think learning to even be able to start, again, starting from the inside place of worshiping in spirit and having the branches stretch out, starting with what it looks like to be hospitable to the people that you live with. Again, if this is really all based on genuine love and worshiping in spirit and what's really true, is it really going to please God if we're extending grace and empathy out here and we're somehow stingy and hostile to the people in our own home? Is that worshiping in spirit and in truth? Or maybe we have to just start and pare back and start right at the beginning. How I'm treating with myself, how I'm treating myself, how I'm loving myself, how am I treating the people under my very roof? Am I gracious? Do I bless and encourage? Do I get up early and make the coffee or leave the light on? Little tiny acts like that, offering to make the bed, to make a call, learning again with this empathy what someone loves. I don't know why, but my mother loves that powdered creamer, which I think is disgusting. But she likes her coffee super hot. She thinks putting anything from the fridge into it makes it colder, and so she'll put palm oil in there instead. So when she comes, I make sure I have disgusting powdered creamer for her. And I don't give her a hard time about it. And it's just this small little way that I make a statement to her, I know you. I'm thinking of you. Those kinds of small acts. Because, and here's the reality, if we begin to live this way, rooted and grounded in love, and you are treating yourself this way, and you are treating the people that you live with this way, I guarantee you this is going to continue to extend. But I think we get it backwards. I think we often try to start maybe doing it out here, and we've not been gracious with ourselves or the people that we're sharing a home with. And then there's something off. There's something that doesn't have integrity. There's something that's not the way it's supposed to be. And hospitality does end up extending beyond our family. You know, in the ancient world, when you'd have to travel in enemy territory, literally survival depended on being able to cross certain boundaries when you were in need, like in the story of the Good Samaritan, to have people meet your human needs when you were away from your people. And so I think that is an important question as well. You know, maybe you are one of those people who's very good at tending your family, but there are insiders and there are outsiders. How good are you at crossing over and extending hospitality to people that are outside your circle? And again, remembering that if you want to flourish, this is not optional. This is not an option. This is what flourishing looks like, is that God's love and grace flows in and flows out. You know, I'm really praying about right now what to do with our home. You know, when my husband and I got married, we had 5 teenagers living in our house. And so we have 4 bedrooms. And now we have no children in these bedrooms. And so it doesn't feel right to have these empty bedrooms. And I'm really praying about, God, what do you want us to do? We've got the Monterey Institute of International Studies. There's a lot of international students that come. You know, we're thinking of maybe having an invitation. My husband's mother comes and stays with us at times, making that more permanent. But Lord, this is what I have. How do you want me to use that? To pray about whatever it is that you have that could begin to be that extension of hospitality. So I want to look for a minute about what are the things that sometimes get in the way of this flow, of God's flow in and our branches flowing out. Well, part of it, I do think that, as I said before, that we shrink our role in this great story, of redemption, when we sometimes will live either in denial, we'll live in these illusions, we'll want a cocoon, we'll want to retreat to our world, especially maybe if you've had a difficult life, you may kind of feel like, you know, I just need to kind of hang back and take care of myself. And maybe for a season that's true. But if we live too much of our life there, like a lot of people do, we will be missing a crucial component of cocooning. You know, I love in one of John Ortberg's books, he says, what is the name of the best-selling chair in the United States? And I'll give you a guess. It's not Risky Boy, and it's not Worker Boy. And the reality is sometimes we do get lulled to sleep, don't we? And we just get lazy. And we do live our life getting caught up in work, and then we come home and we want to rest and we want to watch American Idol and then get up and do it again tomorrow. And that way of life, again, is like standing on that platform and missing this amazing, amazing adventure that God has for us. But I think deep down, and I know this is true for me, I think the biggest reason why I don't live with that part of flourishing that has to do with branches is that I get afraid, that I lack courage. And even when I will go, I'm starting to do some more work in my practice with people that are severely mentally ill. And even that sometimes, as I've been equipped to deal with people that are severely mentally ill, I get afraid sometimes when I'm in the presence of someone who's really floridly psychotic and they're saying things that are frightening to me and they're acting in ways they're hurting themselves or they're acting in ways that I don't understand and I can't connect. And I both feel afraid of what's going to happen. I feel very out of control. I don't know what's going to happen. Like the time one person came and said, "You don't know if this is a real gun or my finger, do you?" And I was really frightened, and I didn't know. And that will happen sometimes if you reach out to people who are mentally ill. And I know that I have, without a shadow of a doubt, I have a strong sense God's calling me to do this and not just stay in my safe office with the people that just want to grow in their intimacy and their relationships. I love that. That is my comfort zone. But I'm being called out into places that feel more frightening to me. Gary Haugen at this conference I went to a few weeks ago at Fuller said, "When do you think the disciples figured out that following Jesus was going to be dangerous?" You know, because don't you get this picture as the story begins, there's this sunny shore and they're fishing and Jesus says, "Follow me," with this look of love in his eyes. And it's kind of like Mount Hermon and they're just hanging out and learning about the kingdom of God and, you know, sitting on this hillside and multiplying the feast, you know, the loaves and the fishes. And this is so cool. And you wonder, when did it begin to dawn on them that this was going to be really dangerous? And literally, every one of them was going to end up losing their life. And so for us, if there's nothing scary going on in our life, nothing scary, nothing that's really outside of our comfort zone, does that feel like that could really be kind of faithfulness and discipleship and flourishing that we're called to share in the sufferings of Christ, to imitate Jesus, and nothing scary? But we are afraid. I'm afraid. But what I realize is fear is the price of growth. When my husband came down to Los Angeles and asked me if I was interested in dating him, I said, "No, I'm really not." Because I had been through a very difficult time of separation and divorce. I had just gotten my family into a little house for the first time that I'd purchased. We didn't have any more financial insanity, taken years to get out of all the financial insanity. I had my practice, I had a ministry, I had good friends. It was all good. And then this person came and said, "Do you want a date?" And I said, "You know, I really don't. I don't want to take that risk. I don't want my children to be exposed to that. I just want to do my thing and be a mother bear, and I'll date after they go to college." That was my plan. And he just said, "Well, would you be open to communicating?" And as I've often said, you know, how does a Christian psychologist say, "No, I will not be open. I will be rigidly closed-minded and small and petty and afraid." No, you know, I said, "Yes, I will be open." And that was all it took. That was a step. And I went home and I said, "God, I guess if I said that out loud, I should say that to you. I will be open." And in an amazing series of events, my heart was stretched wide open. And 6 months later, we were engaged. I would never recommend that to anyone who came to me. And it was really frightening. And I ended up moving my children up 365 miles north. And I didn't know how they were going to do. I became a stepmother. For those of you who are stepmothers, God bless you. Being a stepmother, I'm sure a stepfather too, is an incredibly difficult role. And I was really afraid. And I also let go of a practice that was thriving and flourishing. And I came up to start all over again in a town where I didn't know anybody. And I didn't know what was going to happen financially. I didn't know what was going to happen emotionally. But by the time I moved up, I was convinced that God was saying, "Come. this is my call. And I realize now, in my protective mode of wanting to keep my children safe and not extend my branches in any new way, and just stay right here, what I would have been robbing my two children of was, as they went through adolescence, they got to have a picture of a man and a woman, a husband and wife, who love the Lord together, who respect each other, who play together. My children got to have an experience of a stepfather who was able to give them many things their own father, for lots of different reasons, was not able to give. He poured into my children's lives in ways that they would not have had that experience if I had stayed in my self-protective, frightened mode. But we get afraid. But what's the cost of not pushing through fear? Because it's very costly. Not only will we miss God's adventure, which is the most important thing, but just even humanly, what I see a lot in my work is that when we don't push through fear, it's an enormous loss to our self-esteem. Because I believe very much that our self-esteem is not so much based on how beautiful or intelligent or gifted or successful we are, but I think our self-esteem is very much based on how do you handle a challenge. When something difficult comes into your life, do you face it? Do you address it? Do you deal with it? Do you learn from it and move through it? So it becomes kind of grist for the mill and folded into the fabric of your life? Or when you face a very difficult challenge, do you fold? Do you avoid? Do you run away? And I think that's what really undermines people's confidence. Because you do that a few times, and you begin to profoundly doubt what you're made of and what's inside of you. And you're much less likely to take a risk, and you're much less likely to put yourself in places where you might be tested because you have failed before. And so the cost of not pushing through fear is, I think, for our life to become smaller and smaller and smaller. Avoidance will kill our confidence. And it also forces us to begin living in a false way because we don't want to admit that. So we'll begin acting braver than we really are, or having some kind of a false self. More, like I was saying before, we become more disconnected from our real self. And also fear, not pushing through fear, absolutely destroys joy. I mean, how many deeply joyful and chronically worried people do you know? That when we let fear rob us and wrap around our hearts, we will be absolutely robbed of joy. And we also will lose, again, as I've talked about a lot today, when we avoid the risk, we avoid the conflict, we avoid the anxiety, which many people I know spend a lot of effort avoiding, we lose intimacy. And why that is that intimacy calls us out of the world or the kingdom of self. If I'm going to live in a life of intimacy, I've got to begin realizing that life involves you. And when life involves you, when life involves someone across the world that I can't even relate to the way they live life, and I'm trying to be intimate with them and to love them, there's going to be conflict. What do I do about that? What does God want me to do about hurting people? Well, if you don't want to struggle with that question or that conflict and you want to avoid that whole thing, you're going to pull back, and your life's going to become smaller, and you may not have that hassle, that struggle, but you will become smaller and smaller. And if we do decide to do something, we're going to be taking a risk, aren't we? And we're going to have anxiety, won't we? Because we won't be in control, it won't be safe, it won't be familiar, but it will be right where God's wanting us to extend. And that's what I believe, that the part, if you spend time wanting to be planted by a stream of water and to have a real and genuine intimacy with God, I don't think we have to worry about what we're going to do with the world. The Lord will speak to you. Your gifts, your personality, your circumstances, people will come to you, a book will come to you, a sermon, a person in your church. You don't have to sweat that. You will know. And it will be that flow of being rooted and grounded in love and then being able to extend out. I want to play another song by Sarah Groves to end again today. And what this song is about is what we're talking about of Sarah not wanting to miss out on being a part of when the saints go marching in, that she wants to be a part of that group. And she talks about this idea of not missing out because of fear on this amazing adventure of faith. So let's hear the song by Sarah, and then we'll end for tonight.